DC Comics Podcast. I'm your host, Adam, and with me is my co-host, Jordan. Jordan, how are you?
Dude, I am so excited for tonight's episode because tonight, not only do we have a very special guest on who we'll get to a little bit later, but tonight I finally get to gush about Bat-Cat on the show without you telling me that it has nothing to do with what we're talking about. So I actually get to do it as part of our show tonight, for real.
Isn't it nice when you're talking about something that's actually relevant to the show?
It is.
So
I mean, I can't promise you in the future that I won't bring up Bat-Cat when it has nothing to do with what we're talking about. But at least for tonight, I'm supposed to be talking about it.
I've come to expect that from you, so it's nothing surprising at this point because we're so many episodes in. By the way, what episode are we on? Tell the listeners in case they've lost track.
We are on episode 14, and this is sort of our special Christmas episode.
It is our Christmas episode.
Merry Christmas to those of you who celebrate Christmas, and yeah.
Yeah, I mean, by the time you're here, you're listening to this, we will be days away from Christmas. So I'd like to wish all our listeners who celebrate a Merry Christmas, and I would like to wish our non-Christmas celebrating listeners, and I know that's a poor way of putting it, but whatever holiday you do celebrate, happy holidays. And if it's just a normal day for you, have a great day. Being Christmas, actually, before, you know what, there's no news. So I want to go on a little bit of a tangent. It was brought to my attention that one of our listeners questioned you, Jordan, about why I dislike Smallville. that is a misrepresentation, a misunderstanding. I do not dislike Smallville. In fact, I really, really, really like Smallville. I watched it from episode one. I spent 10 years of my life watching the show. And I think for the most part, when Smallville got things right, it was great. There are just certain things that come along with Smallville, the network it was on, and the mere fact of it's a show that ran 10 years. So in that 10 years, there are going to be episodes that I describe as filler that, in my opinion, weren't the best of the bunch. Some of them were, in my opinion, awful. I know Jordan thinks everything was great about Smallville. And so those are the things that I have a problem with Smallville. But overall, it's an integral part of the Superman legend. And I really enjoyed it. And I'm going to be revisiting it shortly as we are on the podcast. So if anybody thinks I dislike Smallville, that's not the impression I wanna give off. I really do like it. And I just like to pick apart the episodes that are flawed, even though Jordan has red and blue colored glasses on when he talks about these episodes. So that's the crux of the issue. So I hope that clears up the misunderstanding for that particular listener.
Oh yeah. I think he was partially joking. He tweeted me, and I'll give you a shout out, Ryan. Because we're actually, I invited Ryan on to come talk with us about Smallville when we eventually get to it, because we've got a whole series of Smallville episodes planned. And I was talking to Ryan, and I said that it was mostly my overwhelming love for the series rather than your dislike of the series that made it sound that way. But that you do like the series. It's just my overwhelming love for it can get overwhelming sometimes, I suppose.
so Ryan, there's my Christmas gift to you, and you can happily celebrate your holidays knowing that I really do enjoy Smallville. Moving on, we are not doing these Smallville Christmas episodes today. Maybe in a Christmas, in the near future, we will do a Smallville, an episode of Smallville specifically for Christmas.
Oh, that's not a maybe, Adam.
Okay, we will do it, but I don't know which Christmas that's going to be, so I'm not going to go that far ahead in the future. But what we are doing is we have two things on the agenda tonight. We are getting back to, finally, Batman the Animated Series, and we took a strategic pause just for this occasion. And in addition to the Batman the Animated Series Christmas-related episode, that is titled Christmas with the Joker, we are going to be reviewing, as we did last episode, with 1989's Batman, directed by Tim Burton. Today, we are going to be reviewing the Christmas-themed or taking place during Christmas theme film, the sequel, Batman Returns, also directed by Tim Burton. Once again, starring Michael Keaton, but we'll get in more to that in a bit when our guest arrives. And no, our guest is not en route via Santa Claus, or maybe he is. I don't know. But that's we'll ask him when he gets here if we remember. But let's get right into it, Jordan. Let's talk about Batman the Animated Series. The episode was Christmas with the Joker, as I previously mentioned. The funny thing is with this episode is that if you look on IMDb, it's listed as like episode 38 or something like that, 36, 38, something along those lines. But on the DVD and soon to be Blu-ray, it's listed as the second episode of the series.
Well, it's the difference between release order and production order, because in production order, it's the second episode. But in release order, it's the 38th episode, I believe.
I see. So give us a general description of what happens in the episode.
Yeah, well, the clown, Prince of Crime, escapes from Arkham Asylum, and he basically kidnaps Commissioner Gordon and Harvey Bullock and Summer Gleason on Christmas. And so all Robin wants to do that night is stay home at Wayne Manor and watch It's a Wonderful Life with Bruce. And instead, you know, those plans don't go so well because they wind up having to save these hostages from the Joker.
And yeah, that's pretty much the gist of the episode. What's interesting for me, especially first of all, is that this, because if you take it literally as the second episode of that we're doing, and it is. So for the purposes of the DVD, this is our first introduction to Robin. It is the Dick Grayson incarnation, though his costume looks very much Tim Drake inspired. Like gone are the shorts and the little elf boots, thank God. And in its place, you know, is again, like I said, it's a virtual replica of the Tim Drake costume, and I think it works really well. I also like that Dick Grayson in this is already a college student, because with the exception of Damian Wayne, who is 13. Last time I checked, he could be older at this point. But when he first assumes the Robin mantle, he's 13.
I think he turns 13 because he turned 13 at the beginning of Rebirth. So I think before that he was even younger. Yeah.
Okay. Well, here's my thing. I'm of the belief that if you go too young with Robin, it gets a little bit, to me, it's a little unbelievable, like too unbelievable. Like I think the minimum he's got to be a teenager. I actually like that, at least for the animated purposes, they went with a college-age Dick Grayson. It just, to me, it seems more, like I said, believable. And I know it's a cartoon, but I'm a stickler for that kind of stuff sometimes. So I dug that. Well, I also, you mentioned the Joker and the fact that he kidnaps Gordon, Bullock, and Summer Gleason. By the way, whenever you hear Summer Gleason's name, am I the only one that thinks of summer glow, or is that just my hang is that just my hang up, or does everybody else have that problem? But
I don't know. I'm curious. Maybe the listeners have that. I've never thought about that before. But you know, there's a DC connection there, because she's Isabel Rochev back on season two of Arrow. So
and she was Supergirl in Superman Batman Apocalypse. So
yes, indeed.
Which we will review at some point on the show.
I love that movie.
Yeah, it's one of my favorites. So the fact that the Joker kidnaps them is interesting, and so too is the fact that he basically hijacks the TV presentation of It's a Wonderful Life. I think that's significant because it mirrors Joker's first appearance in a way, where he hijacked a radio program, because back then in the 30s it was radio programming.
At least he didn't say the Joker has spoken over and over again.
right. That's what I mean. It's just vintage comics. That's you know you're in for that kind of thing when you read them. But I like that. I like that it mirrored the Joker's first appearance in that way, hijacking, be it you know in this case it was TV, but back then it was radio. So I like that. That was a nice callback. And I think it was intentional, in my opinion. You know, and in the episode, if Batman and Robin can get, you know, around the traps that he's laid throughout the city and reach the location that, that he'll release his hostages. And, you know, the idea of the hostages and everything, and just the Joker's general modus operandi is a very dark thing. But what I like that this show does is it balances the fanciful stuff. You know, like the over the top, you know, like he escapes, wasn't it like a rocket or a Christmas tree with a rocket on the edge? Yeah, right. So, it's a giant Christmas tree that he's riding on to escape, right? And then Batman and Robin fight the big giant Nutcracker statues. So while it stays dark, it has that edgy, you know, psychotic Joker that we've come to expect. It also calls back the hijinks of the 66 Joker in a way a little bit too, and I appreciated that. You know,
for me it went a little too far with some of that stuff, like that, like the hand puppet and him. Going off in the Christmas tree, that got away from it. That was a little too much for me. But I agree with you on some of it in terms of it did. There was still a darkness to the Joker in this episode where he's gonna destroy the train that Summer Gleason's mom is on. So there is some sinister, you know, things that he's doing in this episode. But there were parts where it got a little out of hand for me.
Mm-hmm. Fair enough. But it was definitely, you could definitely see that they were homaging. Batman 66 and Cesar Romero, which is what the other thing that I found great was the fact that Batman had not, or Bruce Wayne had not seen It's a Wonderful Life.
Yes.
The reason I find that great is because neither have I.
yeah, me neither.
And everybody tells me, "Oh, it's a great Christmas. One of my favorites." You know, Christmas movies, and I'm like, yeah, I just can't get into it. Like to me,
couldn't get past the name, Adam.
What's that?
I said you couldn't get past the name,
no,
Adam.
Okay, look, if Wonder Woman 2 takes place during Christmas, you can call it, you can subtitle it, It's a Wonderful Life, and then I'll watch it. But until then, I just can't get into it. Like to me, give me the classics, give me a Christmas Carol. I love that, you know.
Hey, give you the movie we're talking about later in this episode, Batman Returns.
Right, I didn't want to spoil it, but I'll get to it later. But you know, in terms of the classics, the Christmas movies, you know, the traditional Christmas movies, you know, give me a Christmas Carol. I like the Muppet version of Christmas Carol. See, I have the inner kid in me, and the Muppet version has Michael Caine, one of our Alfred's past as Scrooge. Even the Bill Murray, like the Scrooge, the actual movie Scrooged, that's one of my favorite Christmas movies. So It's a Wonderful, you know, the Home Alone movies. It's a Wonderful Life never makes my rotation. You know, The Grinch is another one of my favorites, but It's a Wonderful Life never makes my rotation. And so the fact that Bruce Wayne had never, you know, Batman had never watched It's a Wonderful Life appealed to me because it's something I can relate with Batman to. So good on this episode for including that. Overall, like I said, I really enjoyed this episode. We got a balance of sinister and over the top Joker. It was Gotham at Christmas time, and it was something I loved. And it was also not literally, but Dick Grayson and Robin to me was the epitome of the kind of, like, he was an amalgamation of the ghost of Christmas past, present, and future, in the sense that he was trying to convince Bruce Wayne to just, like, for one night, embrace, like, forget about your crusade, forget about this, forget about being, you know, a curmudgeon, you know, because he's so miserable with the crime and everything, and just enjoy the spirit of the season. And in that way, I thought Robin in this episode was a stand-in for the three spirits that visit Scrooge, with Batman being propositioned as a Scrooge-type character. So I appreciated that, or at least I got that from this episode. So overall, I really like this episode, and it's one that I frequently pop in during the holidays. Is there anything you specifically from this episode that you want to add, whether it's a enjoyment, a like, or dislike?
Oh, yeah. Well, this episode, like some of the others we've talked about, and this is going to be a recurring theme as we go through some of the early episodes of Batman the Animated Series, I've talked about it before, how I didn't watch this during its original run. I wasn't born yet during its original run. I was born during the run of the new Batman Adventures, actually. So that's how young I am. But I had VHS tapes of this show, you know, growing up. But I only had a select few, and the first five episodes in production order were on one of them. And so this is one of them, because this is the second episode in production order. It's the third one we're talking about, because we did do Nothing to Fear first so that we could get to this for Christmas. But this episode was one of those. So I have, for those first five episodes and some others that I had in VHS, those are some of the ones that I have the most love for, because I really did grow up with these episodes in particular.
And that makes sense.
Yeah. I mean, it's nostalgia on that level. But this is an episode that now I watch every single year at Christmas. It's part of my DC Christmas rotation. I've got a bunch of stuff in there. I've got Batman Returns in there, like we're going to talk about later. I've got Holiday Nights, which is the new Batman Adventures Christmas episode. Comfort and Joy, the Justice League Christmas episode. Lexmas from Smallville. But a bunch of episodes, a bunch of DC stuff in my Christmas rotation. This is one of them. So I love watching this every year around Christmas time. And I do have some issues with it, so I guess I'll start with those first. I do think, like I was saying, I brought up what you were talking about. For me, the Joker in this episode was a little too over the top. He was. And, like, this is sort of a recurring theme with him in Batman the Animated Series. I love Mark Hamill's voice performance, but they gave him they made him too campy at times in this series. And like I said, there's some sinister stuff that he does in this episode, like him with trying to destroy the train that Summer Gleason's mom is on, and how he sort of revels in that. But for me, this version of the Joker, the DCAU continuity Joker, didn't really the only time when he really was scary to me is in Batman Beyond: Return of the Joker in the flashbacks. Like, that's the only truly terror thing where I was, like, genuinely scared of him, and where he's genuinely doing something that I'm like, wow, that is terrible. And it's like, you know what I'm saying, Adam?
Fair enough. Yeah, I totally understand that. Yeah.
Okay. All right. So that's just where I'm coming from with him. But in this episode, of course, Mark Hamill, as always, gives a brilliant performance. The only other little thing I'm going to point out is, like, a sort of a nitpick of this episode is at the end of the episode, Batman has this line once he apprehends Joker where he goes, "Merry Christmas, Joker." And that line just makes me roll my eyes every time. Is that really something that we're thinking Batman's going to say to the Joker, "Merry Christmas, Joker," after apprehending him? After Joker's about to kill all these people, Batman's going to make a quip like that, like, "Merry Christmas,
yeah,
Joker"?
It's the same thing, the same reason I have a problem with, you know, in Justice League, Ben Affleck's Batman's like, you know, oh yeah, like when Superman says, "Do you bleed?" and then throws him, and he's struggling to get up. And he's like, "Oh yeah, something's definitely broken." I'm like, "No, Batman would grunt and you know and moan miserably, but he's not Iron Man. He wouldn't make that quip." So I get what you're saying.
You see, that one worked for me.
All right, I don't argue. It's Christmas. I'm in a good mood. I've had an abundance of chocolate, and I'm good.
That's fair. That's fair. I feel like we did talk about that a little bit on our Justice League review.
I don't know if I said that, so I'm saying it now.
Okay. I want to say maybe you didn't. I can't. I thought you did, but anyway, it's all good. This one definitely didn't work for me anyway. But one thing I did, I'll get into my positives now. I loved that. Just like you, I love that Batman hadn't seen It's a Wonderful Life, and really, it's sort of a throwaway line, but it's a really poignant and powerful line when he says, "I couldn't get past the title." And it's like,
yes, I agree with him. He's right.
Because it's like Bruce Wayne. Do you look at? I mean, he has. I mean, you look at what made him Batman.
It's
you look
a
at
the life. Yeah.
He's had a really rough life, and so it makes sense that would like, be the case with him.
Mind you, let's put things into perspective. He is a billionaire. I mean, we start feeling overly sorry for him. Let's remember he is a billionaire.
Well, okay, that's fair. But you know what I'm saying here.
I mean,
you know,
let's be honest. Everybody's gonna, the unfortunate situation is everybody's parents die at some point. So it's not like he's the most singular human being. I get the circumstances, but I'm just saying.
Well, what are you saying about the character of Batman now, Adam?
I love the character, and I sympathize with that moment in time. I'm just saying, hey, listen, everybody goes through that, so. It's not singular to him. The way it happened is singular to him, you know, discounting
Spider-Man
and the ridiculousness. But then again, Uncle Ben is not his father, so I don't count that. But this is not a Marvel podcast. We'll save that for April Fools. I'm just saying. I'm just joking around. I love the character. It's a very tragic moment when his parents do get shot in the alley. But it's Christmas, so let's not go there.
But no, I really like that because that sort of has there's an emotional beat there that I think is really it's really nice. I mean, it's nice in a sad way, but you know,
it's nice that he can't get past the title because of trauma.
Yeah,
we'd be great counselors, wouldn't we? We just demoralize our patients. It would be fun.
Oh my goodness! Oh my goodness! let's see, we've got Clive Revel back as Alfred. I can't remember how many episodes he did before they brought in Ephraim Zimbalist Jr., but this is another one, Clive Revel. I thought he was good. He's no Ephraim Zimbalist Jr., but he was good.
Yeah, solid.
But I thought that's interesting to point out. Let's see, Bullock's got some funny moments in this episode, like when he starts just yelling at the Joker and mouthing him off as soon as Joker takes the lollipop out of his, or not the lollipop, the candy cane out of his mouth.
Yes.
Yeah,
that was a good moment. Yeah,
I thought that was really funny. I really love Christmas specials of any show, and you know, this is really, this is a very classic episode of Batman Animated Series. You know, they've even made a DC Collectibles action figure of the Joker in his Christmas sweater from this episode, you know, and all. And so I just, you know, this episode, it's really it puts a smile on my face when I watch this episode, because it really is just a fun Batman Christmas adventure. And, you know, I really like that. You're right. It is the first episode that we get Robin in the series. And I really like, you know, just even very simple scenes like Batman and Robin driving through Gotham in the Batmobile. It's just, there's some great stuff in this episode with that. And, you know, we early on in Batman Animated Series, before they switched first to the Adventures of Batman and Robin and then to the new Batman Adventures, we didn't get much of Dick Grayson. And so it's great that in the second episode, you know, we get our introduction to Dick, and it's I really like, of course, the DCAU version of Dick Grayson, and you know, this really, really, really good episode, man.
I agree. And wouldn't it have been nice if Warner Brothers had delayed that reveal of Brendan Thwaites as Robin, Dick Grayson, from Titans to this week, so we could have tied it in conjunction with our Christmas episode, you know, since Dick Grayson features prominently in this episode of the that we're discussing, would have been more, you know, very symbiotic, but Warner Brothers doesn't consult with us when they release this information. So we can't help it. It is what it is. But overall, again, it's I think it's an episode that stands the test of time as a great addition to anybody's Christmas festivities. So
absolutely.
We recommend adding it to your list of things to do approaching Christmas or on the actual day once you've enjoyed in family and feasting and presents and all that good stuff. And we hope you do. And we will be back. I feel weird grading a Christmas episode because the intent is, you know what I mean? It's different than a standard episode.
Yeah, I can see that. I can see that.
So I think we'll forego the grading. What I'll say is definitely, it's one you'll want to watch, at least once a year, for sure.
Yeah.
And we hope you enjoyed this review, and we will be trying to.
You know what? I am going to give it a grade. I'll give it a grade.
Okay,
I'll give this episode an A-.
That seems like your go-to grade. I think that's your. Is that your curve, and you're just gonna go up and
Let's see.
Wouldn't everybody love to be a student in Jordan's class? the curve would be A-, and you either go up and down from there. It's not a bad way to start.
You just wait, because we haven't gotten to Smallville yet, and we haven't gotten to the Dark Knight trilogy yet. So, Adam, you just wait, because you're gonna be scared how high my ratings are then for
those ratings are gonna be ridiculous. You're gonna see. You're going to hear some moaning and groaning, and not in a good way.
I've given some other grades, I think. I gave the animated Batman 66 films not too high of grades. Suicide Squad, I think I did, because we had Tim on that episode, and I think he used his rating system, but that's like a B for me if I'm doing it letter grade. So there's a few things that I wouldn't have. And Man of Steel, I think I gave Man of Steel an A+. So there's some stuff.
But I agree with you on that one. That's what I'm saying.
On which one?
On Man of Steel, I think I agree with
you. Oh, okay. Yeah. Well, there we go. So anyway.
So that's it. So that we hope you'll watch that episode over and over again like we do every year on Christmas, and we hope you enjoy the fact that we got back to reviewing Batman the Animated Series, hopefully with the DC films franchise on a 13 or well now it's a 12 month hiatus until Aquaman, we can start revisiting the animated series.
We got away from it for a little while because we were doing those movie reviews leading up to Justice League, the our DCEU retrospective sort of. So we should be getting back, I think, to do more consistently the BTAS reviews. That should be fun.
So you'll see them with more regularity, we hope. And we're going to take a quick pause. And on the other side of that pause, we'll have our special guest and our movie review. So stay tuned. Welcome back, and as we promised, we have a movie review, and now we all know that we just finished up a massive DC films. Jordan still likes to call it DCEU. I don't, but we did all the DC films, including Justice League. With that leaves us 12 months to do other DC films to kill time until Aquaman. So we thought, let's go back to the more modern incarnation of Batman. We recently did a movie that started my Batman fandom, Batman 89, with Rick Shue from Batman on Film. And this time, Jordan, we brought in another guest whose podcast, one of the rare podcasts that I actually have time to listen to, and I always have it in my rotation. And having talked to him back and forth for a couple of years now, I couldn't do this episode without this guest, and it's Andy DeGenova from Holy Backcast. Andy, welcome.
Hey, thanks, guys. Thanks for having me. I'm excited about this.
And Jordan, I'm assuming you listen to Holy Backcast. You better, because
otherwise
it looks terrible on you.
I got to say, Holy Backcast is what got me into listening to podcasts, really. It was the first podcast. Now I listen to a ton of DC podcasts, but that was the first one. I started listening back in spring of 2015, and I was in college at the time. And summer of 2015, I should say, really more so. And what's so funny about your show, man, is I really don't know if I'd be here podcasting with Adam if it wasn't for your show, because I got in contact with him after he guested on your show. And then he eventually asked me to come co-host this podcast with him. But I can still – I have so many great memories from your podcast, because I can still remember times when – I can remember where I was listening to certain episodes of your podcast back then. Like, I can remember exactly where I was sitting at the Hartford, Connecticut airport listening to your Batman and Robin review with Sean Gerber. So
that is awesome. No, I mean, that's so nice to say. Thank you for saying that. I'm glad, you know, thanks for listening. And even if you didn't listen, you could lie to me. I don't mind. But, you know, if I played some small part into you jumping into this crazy world of podcasting, then that's an honor. I love that. Thank you.
So Ed, yeah, well, thank you. If I eventually fire him for mentioning Batman and Robin too often and his love for that film, I can just blame it on Jamie then, I guess, because I won't blame Andy. We'll just blame Jamie for whatever reason.
Blame Jamie. Yeah. He's not here to defend himself. Exactly. And you know, someone's got to love Batman and Robin, so God bless you, Jordan.
Exactly. It was meant for
a lot of people worked really hard on that movie. Someone should appreciate it.
Well, I think Adam's a little bit hyperbolic about my quote-unquote love for that movie, but I do like that movie. No, so
my hyperbole is justified. But thankfully, we're not talking about that movie today. We are talking about the second film in the Tim Burton, Joel Schumacher quadrology, Batman Returns. Before we get into it, Andy, I just have to ask this question. I've asked it of pretty much all of our guests, except for the ones that I forgot to ask. But two questions. Favorite Batman and favorite Batman movie?
See, it's so hard, but okay. So favorite Batman movie is Batman 89, because it's the movie that made me fall in love with Batman. And so I don't think it's the best Batman movie. I still say Batman Begins is the best Batman movie, but Batman 89 is the one that really changed my life without exaggerating. So it's always going to hold that special place in my heart. And likewise, that also means Michael Keaton is my favorite Batman. I think Christian Bale was a great Batman, so I love him, and I love Affleck as Batman. I love Adam West. I love a lot of Batman, but Keaton is my sentimental favorite, just because I fell in love with Batman because of Batman 89. And so at that time, Keaton was my Batman. And not to mention, I do think he gives great performances in his two films. And so especially considering that people didn't think he could pull it off. And I think that he pulls it off great. So yeah, that would have to be my answer.
All right. And see how he did that? He just rolled one answer into the other one. It was flawless. It was good. It's a veteran podcaster at work here, folks. So, Jordan, why don't we get this thing started? Give us a brief synopsis of a movie that everybody who listens to this podcast should have seen. But anyway, just in case they haven't, if they live on some alternate universe where Batman Returns does not exist, what is the summary for the movie?
Well, that would be a sad, sad alternate universe. But IMDb is back to a one-sentence description for this one. So when a corrupt businessman and the grotesque Penguin plot to take control of Gotham City, only Batman can stop them, while the Catwoman has her own agenda.
Oddly enough, that one sentence works. I mean, it's amazing how little they can say, yet it works.
Yeah, it's not bad.
So, Andy, let's start with positives. Let's start. What did you like about this film? By the way, spoiler warning again, 25 plus years old. I can't help you if you haven't seen this movie. So go ahead, spoil away. What did you like?
Sure. And number one, I love this movie. I do. I watch it every Christmas. So thank you guys for having me on the Christmas episode. Batman Returns is a Christmas tradition for me at this point. And there's a lot to love about this movie, honestly. I am a Batman fan, and I am a Tim Burton fan. So I guess from the highest level, what I love about this movie is just how bonkers it is. So some Batman fans don't love this movie, and I get that, and I don't even blame them, because it is a really bizarre film. But I like bizarre, and so I love the boundaries that Burton pushed here. I love this Batman, as I already mentioned. I love Michael Keaton as Batman. I love this version of the Penguin. I like the way Tim Burton reimagined the Penguin because I was never a big Penguin fan. I don't think Tim Burton was either. And so Tim Burton tried to make the Penguin into someone who interested him as a character. And it worked for me, too. I really like this version of the Penguin. I love this version of Catwoman. That is one thing that most people agree on, is that Michelle Pfeiffer just kills it as Catwoman. So I think that all the main characters are terrific in this movie. And then the wild card of Max Schreck. When I was a kid, I didn't quite appreciate Max Schreck for who he was, because for me, I was like, that's just a character that's taking time away from Batman. But the older I've gotten and the more time, you know, the more I've just come to appreciate the film for what it is. I love Christopher Walken as Max Schreck. I think that he's a wild card that at first I considered a negative, but now I consider it a positive because he's just really entertaining to watch. I love the music. Danny Elfman's score is terrific here. I really like Gotham City. I like that it's a Christmas movie. There's a lot to like here. The other thing I'll say is I love the script to this movie. I think that the dialogue is really strong and really interesting and really clever and really smart. And so there are a lot of pieces of dialogue that I've quoted for years, and I just think they're incredibly they're funny or they're smart. Like one of the lines that I always think of is when Bruce Wayne and Selina Kyle are on their date, and Selina Kyle says, "It's the so-called normal guys who always let you down. Sickos never scare me. At least they're committed." I'm like, that's a terrific line, right? And there's a lot of that throughout the movie. Like they're not super real, like real life. They're very clever, but it adds that sense of theatricality where like the Penguin says, you know, "I'll murder you momentarily." Like no one talks like that, but for the Penguin to talk like that, it's great. I love almost everything about the movie. There are some things I don't love, which I think we get into in a minute. But yeah, for me, the music, the production design, the performances all around. I think that I love the design aesthetic, because I'm a Burton guy, and I love how he really just brought Gotham to light through the lens of like German expressionism. I think that was really just a cool new approach. And so, yeah, for me, there's just tons to love here. I love that the story that the more you dig into this film, the more you appreciate the story they were telling. And that is something I don't think a lot of people appreciate about the movie because they haven't given it that much thought. So, you know, Tim Burton talks about the fact that the movie is really, you know, it's about your animal side and your human side. And so every character in the movie has an animal side and a human side. So Bruce Wayne obviously has Bruce Wayne and Batman. Selina Kyle has Selina Kyle and Catwoman. The Penguin has Oswald Cobblepot and the Penguin. And even Max Schreck has Max Schreck, respected businessman and underhanded monster who's trying to control Gotham. So, because of that, and the more you like dig into that and to see how those sides are really at war with each other throughout the movie, you know, like to watch Penguin's arc of like starting as an animal, trying to go legit and become a respected member of society by becoming the mayor, and then getting rejected again and then reverting back to animal. It's a really cool arc for that character. So there are a lot of great things like that that I love about the movie that you really have to just, you know, focus in on and enjoy.
And it's good that you point that out because a lot of people don't go that far into the thinking about it. They just, you know, mm-hmm. it's all surface level stuff. So that's, I'm glad you pointed that out. For me, what I really liked was the fact that, I mean, it dawned on me as a kid watching this movie that Batman and his world, there's a lot of animalistic like references. But I thought when I was a kid, I looked at it on the surface level, you know, Batman, okay, and we have Penguin and Catwoman. And I thought those villains, that collection of hero and those two villains, I think naturally it makes sense to put, like, in a weird way, Catwoman and Penguin together. Whereas, mm-hmm. you know, Mr. Freeze and Poison Ivy as a pairing doesn't make sense. I like that, like, from the first, you know, the whole Christmas angle, as you said off the top, I'm like you. Every year at Christmas time, I watch this. It's my favorite Christmas movie, and I make no bones about it. I don't care if people disagree with me. It is what it is. And the visually, it's stunning. I love how, you know, that opening shot of Wayne Manor. How it's like, it seems like it's so far away from everything else in Gotham. Like it's separate from Gotham City. He's almost like the way it's perched. I think it was on a cliff of some sort. It's like he's watching over Gotham City from his house. And that opening shot of, you know, Bruce sitting in his, or one of the opening shots, sitting in his study, and the bat signal goes off, and then, you know, he's got those reflectors that beam it into the house. Like that scene, I mean, there's a gif of it, and it's just, I imagine myself as Bruce Wayne when I'm sitting in my den reading a comic book, just waiting for the signal. It never does. It's disappointing, but it is what it is. Your Penguin comment at the top was perfectly in sync with me, because I've never been a Penguin fan per se. My first exposure really to the Penguin, because before I started reading comics, I was it was basically what I had seen in the Adam West series and then the movies, you know, the first two movies. And I was a little too young when I watched the reruns of 66 to kind of totally like get what was going on with the Penguin. So My first real exposure to Penguin was Danny DeVito, and I thought he was fantastic. You're right, it's weird. It's not, when you look at it now, it's not really the Penguin in the comics, per se. But it's just, when I think of the Penguin, I automatically think of Danny DeVito. And it's got a little bit of, tell me if you agree with me on this. I don't know, maybe it's just me, my own way of thinking. But it's got a little bit of a Tarzan aspect to it. You know, he's abandoned.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that makes sense.
Thrown in the sewer. And could he have been that sane if Pee Wee Herman was his father, given, you know, all the stuff with the actor? But by the way, I put it in that connection. What was his name? Ruben. What's the actor's name? Ruben something or the Pee Wee Herman guy.
Paul Rubens.
Yeah, Paul Rubens. Yeah, that's it.
Paul Rubens.
He also shows up in Gotham. So for me, in my head canon, it kind of somehow loosely connects. But that's just me. But the whole sewer thing and being raised, quote unquote, raised by the Penguins, it gave me a Tarzan vibe that I thought was, it's like bizarro Tarzan, because there's nothing really aesthetically beautiful about it. Like it's the exact opposite.
Right. And that makes sense. And the thing about the Penguin is people, like, again, like one of the criticisms is this is not the comic book Penguin. And they certainly changed at least his progression, the progression of the character and the backstory of the character. But he's still Oswald Cobblepot.
Yeah.
Born of Gotham royalty. And he's still a crime boss in the present and putting forth the facade of being respectable. All of that is comic book Penguin. But they just added this extra, what I like to call it, the Phantom of the Opera Penguin. they added that whole Phantom of the Opera backstory that was not really part of the comic book, where he was rejected by his parents and was, you know, raised by penguins in the sewers and was part of a sideshow. And like all of that was added, but it still got him to a place in the film where when he is the Penguin and he's, you know, he's the mob boss, but as far as Gotham knows, he's a respected member of society. Like, that is the same.
Yeah, exactly. It's not so far out of left field like people, you know, selectively like to remember. I think they're choosing to ignore the comic book elements that are there. I think one of the things that struck me as very well done, I think, in the script and how the actors pulled it off, Danny DeVito specifically, was there were several moments in this film where I actually felt sad and sorry, and I pitied this Penguin, this version of the Penguin. Mm-hmm. Like, the stuff where he's trying to embrace his humanity and find out who his parents are it's heartbreaking. It really was heartbreaking. And the score, Danny Elfman's score, you know, really help those emotions along. But I, and then to see him, you know, eventually turn, and then when he's rebuked by the public, he, you know, his plot is to, well, I'm going to get back at you by, you know, he's planning to kidnap and assuming they kill the firstborn of the royalty of Gotham, right? Mm-hmm. So it's deplorable, but it's like, well, given all, I wouldn't advocate him doing what he's doing, but given all the crap he's been through in life and the hand he was dealt, can you really see that as a stretch? I thought it was, I don't want to say well within his right. It's not the right word. It's very plausible that him being so disturbed by being rebuked and then, you know, being ostracized to begin with, and then finding some level of adoration and then being thrown down again, it would lead him to that. So I thought that progression like you were saying, his arc made total sense.
Well, and I think you hit on an important point, and I agree with you in that he's a villain through and through. He's a bad guy, but there are certain moments where he's very sympathetic, where you actually feel for him. And I think none more so than when he finally dies, because like he really just wanted to be a part of our world. He's like the Little Mermaid. He wanted to be a part of our world. And he was rejected again, and to the point where when he dies, like, he's alone and there's no one there for him but his penguins. And it's like a really tragic and sad death. So despite the horrible things that he has done and was planning to do, you still feel bad for him because he was dealt a crappy hand and he was just never able to really pull himself out of that.
Right. And the other thing that I liked about it was that the two, quote unquote, because Catwoman, I mean, she's a villain, but not really in my mind anyway. She kind of walks in this, she's more of a villain, but she, to me, she's always walked that line. So when I say two villains, I'm talking about Penguin and Shrek. It's so beautiful the way they're using each other, and it just, like it just works so beautifully. Like you have Max Shrek trying, like, using him and his situation to try and position him to take over as mayor, so he can push forward his agenda with the what is it, the reactor that he's trying to pass off as
the power plant.
Right. So he's trying to put, you know, his own guy as mayor to pass through his agenda. And here the Penguin's kind of using him first to gain the sort of a little bit of a footing within the high society of Gotham. Right. And then in finding out who he is, he finds the names of all the high society, like the high rollers in Gotham, to later execute his plan. So the fact that they beautifully used each other, it was kind of poetic in a way. And what I loved about Penguin was, and I never noticed this as a kid, and this is the kind of a beauty of it, man, is he a pervert.
Totally.
the double entendre I never got, where like, I was just watching it last night, and some of the lines, I was just like, did he say that? Like, I rewatched it again last night. And there's the one line, and I'm going to say this, pardon my friend, when he walks in, there's some, and the guy says, there's somebody here, to, you know, and he specifies the word body in somebody, and he's like, that's just the pussy I've been looking for. And I'm like, I literally paused it because I had forgot about it. I literally paused it, and I'm like, are you kidding me? And then...
It's pretty, it is shockingly dirty, and I think, like, that's true about the whole movie, is like they pushed the boundaries and they got in trouble for it back in 1992. And what's funny is that as the years have progressed, people have kind of warmed to the movie, which is interesting. But yeah, 1992, people were like, I can't believe I took my kids to this because of stuff like that. I mean, because of some of the gross stuff, because some of the, you know, and especially because some of the dialogue, you're right. Like, Penguin is horny.
And then when he's putting the pin on the girl, like, he's literally groping her. And at one point I'm thinking, wait a minute, this movie, this 1992 film is very topical in 2017 because we have a political candidate who throws the word pussy around flippantly and is okay with groping women. So I was like, this is shockingly relevant. I don't know if they planned this, but here we are. With Catwoman, it's not, again, quote unquote, the traditional Catwoman, but I grew up with this Catwoman, so this is my Catwoman. I mean, Michelle Pfeiffer was so fantastic in this role. The way she went from meek, demure, you know, secretary to this fierce, almost feral-like persona as Catwoman, she balanced the... once she was Catwoman, she balanced that fierceness and, you know, kick-ass motif with being sexy. Like, it wasn't, you know, sacrificing one for the other one. It was a perfect balance. And the fact that she's so meek, but then also you see moments where she's absolutely batshit crazy, excuse the pun. Like, that transformation scene after she's been resurrected by the cats, when she trashes her apartment and, you know, spray paints everywhere and the hell here with the sign, and then makes her own costume. Like, she was bonkers. And it's just, it's a total 180 from where she was at the beginning of the film. And it's impressive. Like, that's an impressive tour de force of acting, in my opinion. That is never as recognized as it should be. I'm not saying it's Oscar worthy, but it's really solid.
Well, there was Oscar buzz back in 1992. Like,
was there? I don't remember.
Oh, yeah. Like, yeah, back in 1992, when this movie came out, everyone agreed that she was great.
But I could see why, though, because, wow.
Yeah. Rightfully so. She's amazing in this. And yeah, so there was some Oscar talk. It didn't materialize. But you know, even the negative reviews were like, well, Michelle Pfeiffer is great as Catwoman. And even to this day, when you talk to people about this movie, people go, oh, best Catwoman. And, you know, whether you agree or disagree, and that's not to take away from some of the other Catwomen, but she left such a mark on this role that to this day, people still celebrate her performance.
Yeah, she was fantastic. And the other thing that was, I think, very well done in again, they only had one movie to do this in, was the push and pull in the relationship with Bruce Wayne and Selina, and then Batman and Catwoman, right? The one scene where you know, there's the classic mistletoe, and the whole fight between the two of them on the rooftop was great. But then the scene that gets me between the two of them is at the party, at the masquerade, when they're dancing, and like, she's borderline, again, bordering on insanity because she wants to kill Shrek. And then,
yeah, one of the best scenes in the film. Just, yeah, so good.
Yeah, and then, you know, they reiterate the line from the fight under the mistletoe, and they realize that, you know, they're Batman and Catwoman. I mean, it was just such a powerful scene. And then when she says, does this mean we have to fight? Like, you could see the emotion and the almost sadness of the realization. Like, right on her face. Like, she didn't have to say anything. You could see it in her eyes. And I thought, man, this is a performance that is just, again, I could sit here and do a podcast about Michelle Pfeiffer's Catwoman in and of itself. It was just great. With Michael Keaton returning as Batman, I like the choice that he made here with Batman not saying much. Like, he's very short when if he's with villains, if he's conversing with a villain or before a fight or whatever, it's often one line and it's very short, to the point, and straightforward. You never see Batman expunge, you know, quotes of dialogue when he's in the costume. And I think that's a cool choice, because would Batman really stand there and, you know, pull a Kevin Smith and just start talking ad nauseum? I don't think so. So I thought it was a different, like, he shortened his dialogue even from Batman 89 tremendously. But I think it works for the character of Batman. And then only when you see him with Alfred is he more talkative and whatnot. And I like that, you know, a lot of people will criticize, you know, this movie and even to an extent 89 for Batman not doing any detective work. But he does. I mean, he tracks down the information about the circus gang, right? When he's eating the cold soup.
Vichyssoise.
Yeah, that's it. And I'm like, I've never had that. I wonder what that tastes like. Every time I watch the movie, it does that to me. And then
it tastes like, have you ever had like cream of potato soup?
Okay, or like that I've had.
It tastes like that, but cold.
Okay, fair enough. That's, yeah. All right, there we go. That curiosity is now cured. and then also when he's like, when he's driving and he's like sort of quote unquote spying on him in when he's at the Hall of Records, right?
Mm-hmm.
So there is an element of detective work in these movies. It's just not flat out outright, you know, like they don't spend a great deal of time on it, but it is there. And I appreciated the moments that it was there,
mm-hmm.
In these films. So yeah, I mean, those are, and then Max Schreck was just such an oddball. Like he's the perfect, he has that public facade, but he's also just right in Tim Burton's Gotham City. He's just flamboyant and odd enough to fit.
Mm-hmm.
He walks that line where he's a little bit more tamer than the other characters in the movie, the other main characters, but he's a little bit more flamboyant, and I think he reminded me of a not at least in look, maybe it's a gray hair or whatever, but like a non-undead version of Beetlejuice, but in a taller version.
Yeah.
I don't know if it was the wardrobe or what it was, but I was getting obviously the Tim Burton connection, but he gave me Beetlejuice vibes for whatever reason. And then in response to like Batman killing, because I know it's a big issue with everybody, when he does it here, and again, whatever instances he may or may not have done it in 89 or how much you blame him, I just look at it like, look, this is the early version of Batman. Like, so if I had to compare it, it would be like the 1939 version of Batman, who for a few issues did kill. So I just excuse it as that. I'm like, all right, it's that iteration of Batman. And that's how I sort of wrote it off or excused it. I like the scene with the circus gang at the beginning, and not gonna lie, seeing him roast one of those crazy guys with the engine of the Batmobile. I thought it was a badass sequence. Whether he was right to do so or a little bit excessively cruel is a fair argument, but damn, it was a great sequence, especially when I was however old I was when this came out. I think I was 9. I thought it was great. So yeah, and I love the Batman Returns suit. I gotta say that. That's another thing I love. And the other thing I didn't mention was, like you, the look of Gotham City. I really do like Tim Burton's take on Gotham City. I know, I don't know if it was because I know Batman Forever is next, but I noticed the big statues a little bit more in this than I did in 89. I don't know if that had anything to do with knowing that Batman Forever was on the horizon, but
The statues get bigger in every movie.
Yes,
like they weren't so huge in 89, and then they got bigger in Returns, then they got even bigger in Forever, and then by the time it was Batman and Robin, they were driving on statues. So
and then the nipples protrude more and more with each film. Especially the latter two. Jordan, what did you think? What were your likes of this movie?
Oh man, I love this movie for many of the same reasons that you guys said. This is my favorite Christmas movie as well, and frankly, it's my favorite DC movie pre-2005 as well. So take that for what you will. I think this movie is just, like Andy said, it is bonkers, and I totally understand some of the criticism that this movie gets, because I totally understand that this tone, it's very stylized, it's very Burton-y. And I totally understand that doesn't work for people. But for me, I love just about every second of this movie, every frame. And I guess I'll start with what I've been dying to talk about. And it's because this is the one episode, or our first episode at least, where I really get to gush about Batcat without Adam interrupting me and telling me that that's not what we're here to talk about this episode. But Bruce and Selina in this movie, man, I mean, it is phenomenal. And just the dynamic that the two of them have, the whole mistletoe thing, that it starts out with them as Batman and Catwoman, and the way that's the reveal, the masquerade ball.
Oh, right, yeah.
Scene that's my favorite scene in this movie, and they start playing. I love that song, Face to Face, and Selena comes down the stairs, and that whole scene. I really do believe you guys brought it up. I really do believe Michelle Pfeiffer should have won an Oscar for this movie, because her performance, the way she breaks down when the reveal. Well, first when she's like, I don't know who. When Bruce asks, who the hell do you think you are, and she starts breaking down, and just that whole. That is some phenomenal acting right there. Mm-hmm,
totally.
And yeah, and the way...
Yeah, you guys both mentioned that scene, and I didn't know how deep we were going, but, like, yeah, that scene...
Yeah, you can mention specific scenes if you
want. Between the two of them, I mean, they both give an amazing performance in that scene, and the acting of just the two of them talking, and it's one of the most magnetic and engaging scenes in the movie. They're so good in this.
Yeah. Yeah, I 100% agree. I 100% agree. And it's that you really do see them. You see how one thing that I think is just so important about the Bat-Cat relationship to me is when these are two characters that are so misunderstood by so many people. And I'm not talking about fans, obviously. I'm talking about people in universe. These are characters that are very much misunderstood. And it's these characters that are very much, in a lot of ways, they don't fit in with society. And it's the same thing with this. The same thing with you sort of see with the Penguin in this movie, so it's sort of a running theme in Batman Returns specifically. But then at the end of the movie, when this comes back up, and this is another scene I love in this movie, where Bruce is trying to talk down something, and he's like, sides of the same thing, and they're talking, and they're like basically Bruce is trying to convince her that, and he's like, I wish I could run away with you, I wish I could come live in the castle, but I just couldn't live with myself, and I think that's so heartbreaking, but it's like, for me, this just did. I wish they could have gotten a happy ending. Another reason I love Rise so much. We haven't seen it yet, but I didn't get that. But for me in this movie, even though they didn't get that happy ending, just the fact that they, talked about it, the fact that they just everything they got so much right about the Bruce and Selena dynamic in this movie, and talking about them individually, like I was saying, Pfeiffer, just a phenomenal performance. The way she makes the transition that when you see her as the secretary at the beginning, and just she's sort of doing almost the Christopher Reeve thing, where she's sort of this bumbling, so different, such a drastic change from who she is as Catwoman, and just that whole transformation scene is just so powerful, where she destroys her apartment and all that, and. That everything about that is phenomenal, and I want to say just because it leads into Max Schreck, because she has a strong connection to him in this movie. I love Christopher Walken in this movie. He has such a strong presence, right? And it's like that scene where he catches her in his office, and that whole thing. I mean, that scene is just Christopher Walken at his finest. And it's like I just think that's so brilliant in this movie. I guess the other villain in this movie, and I like you, Adam. I how many times I've said this on this show. I firmly don't consider Catwoman a villain. So when I say the other villain, I too am talking about when I say the two villains in this movie, I'm talking about the Penguin and I'm talking about Max Schreck. And when it comes to the Penguin, I'm in the same boat. I think you were talking about this, Adam. The Penguin has never been one of my favorite Batman villains. I think that his popularity.
I think Andy said the same thing. I think we're all in agreement here.
Yeah.
He's never been one of my favorite Batman villains. And it's like I think so much of his popularity just comes with the fact that he was such a like Burgess Meredith's portrayal was so iconic on the 60s show. But in terms of him being an interesting villain, he just in most iterations. And I really do think that Tim Burton, even though he did a very weird very Burton-y take on the character, he made him interesting. This is my favorite version of the Penguin. Mm-hmm. And he's hilarious in this movie. There are so many scenes where he just cracks me up. I mean, you talked about how many quotable lines are in this movie, and so many of them come from him. Like, mm-hmm. I quote all the time is, it could be worse. My nose could be gushing blood. And I quote that line all the time when things aren't going well. I'm like, yeah, it could be worse. my nose.
I will say, as a kid, that's the only scene that outright disgusted me, was the biting of the nose. I don't know why. You think
it is pretty nasty.
You think it'd be the raw fish or the sewage coming out of his mouth at the end, but no, it was the biting of the nose.
The raw fish is more for me. The raw fish is a little bit more disgusting, but I love it. That's another thing. Is the way DeVito commits to this performance, and the way he, One thing that is just very subtle about his performance, but that I really love, I don't know if this, I'm guessing this was an acting choice on DeVito's part, how he grunts every time mm-hmm. he walks. There's something about that I love. And, like, the whole thing with him being, like, very Glenn Quagmire-y and, like, hypersexual, I find that, I mean, it's pretty disturbing, but there's also a lot of humor in that I find pretty funny. And but also, you brought it up, Andy, how tragic it is, how at the end, I mean, he really does. I do feel bad for him, despite the fact that mostly I find him comedic in this movie. He is a tragic character at the end. Mm-hmm. Because you brought it up, the only people who are there when he dies are those penguins. And it's like, I mean, that's sad. I mean, his whole story is tragic because it's like these parents who literally threw him out. And it's like, his story, it's a sad one in this movie, but DeVito just totally commits to this performance, and I think he does a stellar job with it. I think Heaton, in this movie, of course, he was great in 89. I think he actually delivers a slightly better performance here. I think that has a lot to do with how much, for me, his relationship with Vicky is just so dull in Batman 89 for me, and it's like, of course, I'm a huge Bat-Cat shipper, so that obviously makes automatically his relationship better for me in Returns, but just, I mean, the way Keaton's chemistry is with Michelle Pfeiffer, it just, he has so much to do in this movie. That scene, I can't remember which one of you guys brought it up, but the scene with him in Wayne Manor when he's brooding, very classic Batman scene, and it's just such an iconic shot of the bat signal in there, and it just, oh man, him standing up, it's awesome. And one more thing I'll mention, Gotham City in snow. I love it.
Totally.
Nothing looks better to me than Gotham and snow.
You know, people think I'm crazy, but I always say if I had to pick a fictional city to live in the DC universe, between Gotham and Metropolis, and I'm talking about any filmic incarnation, like it doesn't matter which one, I'd pick Gotham because, look, it just, I love the architecture, number one. And number two, like, look, if I'm going to die, I'd rather be at the hands of a psychotic but beautiful woman, either Catwoman, Harley Quinn or Poison Ivy, send me up. Like, if I gotta, like the Joker said, if I gotta go with a smile, right?
does Aruba count as a city in the DC universe? Because I was kind of liking what Mick Rory was. I was liking how he was doing Aruba.
Yeah, that was good. I gotta love Mick Rory. But the other thing I'll say too was that I forgot before we get onto our negatives. The positive that I forgot was the tampering with the Batmobile and breaking into the Batmobile and that whole chase, and then when the Batmobile like loses parts to fit into the
to become the Bat missile.
Yes, thank you for putting the words in my mouth. But you know why I think it's a great sequence, but you know why I love it? Because I had that toy
as a kid.
It brings back such memories. I don't have those toys anymore because my mom got rid of them. And I'm still broken up about that. But, you know, my psychiatrist will take care of that, I hope. But
about that scene, I love the penguin's temper tantrum in that scene. It cracks me up every time.
Yeah.
And then one more thing about this movie that I forgot to bring up that sort of makes me sad at the end is it makes me sad for two reasons. One, it's Bruce and Alfred in the car when they're driving away at the end of the movie. One thing that makes me sad is because, I mean, it's sort of the aftermath of his thing with Selina not working out, and that makes me sad. But it also makes me sad knowing that that's Keaton's sort of send-off scene as Batman, knowing that retroactively watching the movie.
Yeah,
and it's it's sort of a bittersweet scene watching it in retrospect, because it is a good way for him to go out in a way, because I think that I there's something really calm about that scene, just them driving through the snow, and I love that scene, but at the same time, it does work. Like, if Keaton has to have a send-off scene, it's a pretty good one, but it also does make me sad knowing it's his last scene as Bruce Wayne.
Yeah, it made me sad too, because I know what comes next.
That's a great point. There were a couple things I wanted to hit on real quick. Sorry, just because Jordan mentioned it, and we all were talking about the penguin, and I feel like everybody agrees how great Michelle Pfeiffer is in this movie, so that's not really up for debate. But I feel like that DeVito never really got the credit he deserved for his performance, because I think he does give a great performance. But I remember when the movie came out, and this might even still be prevailing, is because he was so gross and because he wasn't the Joker, people didn't take to him, because they were like, well, I missed the Joker. I remember, like, that was a thing when this movie came out, is I missed the Joker. And the Penguin is just as entertaining in this movie as the Joker. It's just different. And it's a shame that people didn't quite appreciate how that, you know, something different, which is what led to, of course, the Schumacher movies making everyone the Joker. So, like, DeVito, I think, deserves a lot of credit because he really commits to the role as well. I mean, they all do. And something that Jordan was saying about Keaton's performance in this, you brought up some great examples. I also throw out the example of I love Bruce Wayne's meeting with Max Schreck.
Yes.
Because to see that public Bruce Wayne fighting evil through business is really great. And Keaton is so commanding in that scene too. He's terrific. So he's great. And then there were a couple of things that I noticed. I mentioned earlier about how I really love the script to this movie, or most of the script, we'll put it that way. It's not perfect, but to really bounce off of what Jordan was saying about that final scene, which is a really somber and melancholy way to end the film, as opposed to, like, the end of the first movie was very triumphant. The end of this film is really sad, actually, because it's just Bruce and Alfred driving through a quiet, desolate Gotham City in the snow. But what I love about it is that at the very beginning of the film, when the Penguin emerges and Bruce is looking into him, Alfred says to him, "Must you be the only lonely man beast in town?"
Yes.
And by the end of the film, he is.
Yes.
Wow.
It's there's some powerful stuff in this. I'm telling you, this film doesn't get enough credit.
I didn't think about that, Andy. That's actually a great note. Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow.
And that's a shame because I watched it last night and I didn't pick up on that. But Andy pointing it out, it's brilliant. It's just.
Yeah, like. Oh, trust me, it took me 23 years before I noticed it. Like, it's like, because it's subtle, but I was like, oh my God, like, that's exactly what happens. And it's really, really sad. And then the other piece, much like that, one of my favorite lines in the movie and one of my favorite deliveries of a line is when Max Schreck says to Bruce Wayne, "Bruce, shame on you. You can never have too much power. If my life has a meaning, that's the meaning."
That was a good Christopher Walken, Andy.
Yeah, it's a very good impression.
Wow.
Thanks. And then how does Max Schreck die?
Yeah. Power.
He's too much power.
A lot of it, yeah.
So That is another thing where I was like, oh, God, that's so good. You know, like that they set that up at the beginning is you can never have too much power and it ends up being what kills him. I love that.
It's great stuff. And, you know, yeah, this movie. It's so underrated. I think in the Batman fandom circle. I mean, there are people that outright hate it, and I get why there are things that they don't like. But I mean, there's so much good in this movie. It's one of my favorites. But we've talked about the good. We've been gushing about the good. Is there anything negative that you guys found in this film? Andy, let's start with you.
My biggest complaint with this movie, and it's been the same since the movie came out, is I wish it felt more like a sequel to Batman 89. Mm-hmm. I feel like, you know, and they said it. I think it was a conscious decision from Tim Burton in that he didn't want to repeat himself. And so he essentially started from scratch and just made a new Batman movie, but he didn't make a sequel. And I love continuity between sequels. Like, for me, like, that's what makes a film franchise connect, right? Like, and so the fact that it doesn't feel like the same Gotham City as the first film, and the fact that many of those supporting characters don't carry over into the new film. And so it's stuff like that where I'm like, I just wish that it would have felt like a little bit more of a direct continuation from Batman 89. And that could have just been done by, you know, shooting on, you know, in some of the same, you know, they would have had to go back to England because that's where they shot the first film. The second film was in Burbank here in California. And I think that's why, is they were like, well, we don't want to go to England. Let's just do it here. Yeah. But even if they could have recreated some of that from the first film, just to make it feel like a more direct continuation. at the time, I was like super bummed that like Vicky Vale didn't come back because she was really important. So, and the fact that they just threw her away and we don't, you know, we have to wait halfway through the movie before he gives a very vague explanation for why they didn't work out. So like, especially as a kid, I was like, where, whatever happened to Vicky Vale? And even now I'm like, oh, you know, like they could have had Vicky Vale as part of the film and then it could have create, you know, and then Selena could have created that rift. So it all kind of factors into the same issue. Is I just wish that it felt a little more consistent with the first film. So they held together, because instead it feels like they're almost like two standalone Batman movies with very little in common except for a couple actors. So that's one thing. I'm kind of indifferent to the two occasions that people accuse Batman of killing in this movie. Yeah. I think the fire breather, it's up for debate, because he, you know, he could have just rolled around in the snow and he could have survived.
That's, we don't, true.
You
know, yeah.
You never see a body. I think the strong man with the bomb, he's probably dead. But
oh, yeah, fireworks.
Exactly. I get why people don't like it. I take it as being like, well, you know, like that was action stars in the late 80s, early 90s. And so like, I just kind of go with it, but I get why, you know, like the Batman purists get a little up in arms about that. But I wouldn't call it like a huge negative for me. No. And then the last thing where I'm like, it's just a little goofy and it kind of crosses the line is the penguins with the rockets. I don't hate it the way a lot of fans hate it. So, but it does get, you know, it starts getting really cartoony at that point. There's nothing super realistic about the whole movie. But that's the point where you're like, it gets a little goofy at that point. So, most of those I've just like learned to live with because I'm just used to what the movie is now. Yeah. But yeah, like if I were to go back and say, fix these things, that's probably what I would say. But at this point, I just kind of love the movie on its own because I just accepted that that's what the film is.
Yeah. And there was the other Vicky Vale mention where Alfred was talking about the Batmobile security. And then he's like, yeah. Oh, you're one to talk about security. You're the one who let her into the Batcave, or something along those lines is what he said. I agree with what you said about your negatives. The only one that I'll add is this is just a personal thing for me because I kind of like to have things, certain things explained. And I never understood how the cats resurrected Selina Kyle. Okay, if they're mystical, give me some hint or some explanation of how or why they're mystical. Like, I don't understand it. To this day, I don't understand that. And it'd be nice to have an explanation of how that worked. Again, I've just assumed that, okay, I just got to throw you know, reality out the window and just accept it. But all things being equal, if I could ask Tim Burton a question, it'd be like, how did those cats resurrect Selina Kyle? And that was my biggest issue because as a kid, I remember like, but wait a minute, that doesn't make sense. And now today, I still, even yesterday, I'm like, that still doesn't make sense. And no, Jordan, I know before you say it, I don't count that Catwoman movie as explaining anything. Because a picture of Michelle Pfeiffer does not count.
I was about to say it because that movie does explain. It is in the same continuity, Adam. It's in the same continuity, and it does do a little bit more explanation of the mysticism involved with that. Yeah. So
I will say...
break the tie, Andy. Whose side are you on here?
Oh, geez. No, I'm not breaking the tie. I'm just saying, like, I don't mind it being left intentionally vague, which it is, where it's... And we had this conversation on Holy Batcast when we covered this movie a couple years ago, is my co-host Jamie is like, no, she's dead and comes back to life. I don't think she's dead. I think she has a near-death experience and is as... resurrected in a more metaphoric way.
I agree.
And because they intentionally have her fall through the awnings to break her fall so she could plausibly have survived. So I don't think she's dead. I think that she almost dies. And when she almost dies, she this near-death experience causes her to snap and causes something in her to awaken. And it's this cat spirit that attracts all of these, you know, all these cats. So I don't think the cats resurrected her. I think that it was when this thing was awoken in her, it attracts this energy. But I think it's left intentionally vague, because how do you explain that? Even when I'm saying it out loud, it sounds weird. So that's always the way I've read it, is she almost dies and now she's done. Like, she's tried to play by the rules. She's tried to play in man's world, and all it got her was pushed out a window. Now she's had it, and she, life's a bitch, and now so is she.
That's right. You know what? I buy your explanation. I'll take it. the inner child in me will take it, and the adult will take it. So thank you for that. Jordan? Any negatives on your part?
Yeah. First of all, Vicky not being in this movie for me is a positive. So that's all I'm going to say on that.
No, and I think your point is valid. Honestly, like when you said, yeah, like the Bruce and Vicky stuff is kind of boring. I don't disagree. Like, there's nothing super exciting about that relationship. Again, it was more of, especially when the movie came out, of me being a little kid being like, no, Vicky Vale like is an important character. She was in the first movie. Where is she? Now, as I'm older, I'm like, oh yeah, like the Bruce Selena is way more interesting than the Bruce and Vicky. So I agree with you. It was more of like a residual complaint from 25 years ago.
Okay. Yeah. On that level, I totally get it.
By the way, Jordan, watch what you say about Kim Basinger, because her and Michelle Pfeiffer in these two movies were my first celebrity crushes. So I'll just, that's what I'll say. I'll leave it at that. Continue with your negatives.
Yeah. Just two things I was going to throw in real quick that I forgot my positives. One, the ice princess is so funny in this movie, and her trying to go over whether she presses the button and then the tree lights up, or whether the tree lights up and then she presses the button, cracks me up every time. And this is my favorite Danny Elfman music score as well. So I want to throw those two things in there as positives. Now, moving on to my negatives, it's just three little tiny nitpicks in this movie. I love this movie so much. There's only like a couple things that I don't like about this movie. One, it's that Bruce and Selena don't get a happy ending. Two, it's that there's bat signals around Wayne Manor. And I'm like, how does nobody notice that Bruce Wayne has bat signals shining into his house?
But it's so far off, and nobody ever goes there. He's alone.
He had a whole party in it. He had a whole party in it in the last movie.
He added those later. That's my excuse.
Well, and they're obviously mobile, so they might be turned in, so you can't actually see them unless they activate. And yes. I guess he just has to hope that no one's around when they activate. So
you know what? That's fair, because I want to not dislike that. So I'm gonna,
because you don't that. Yeah, because you don't really know where they are on the house. They could be. You know, like you don't see where they are. You just know that they're there. So they could be masked by parts of the house for okay. all we know.
I'll take it.
I'm sure there's some amazing geek out there who's drawn a schematic of Wayne Manor and put them there and knows where they are. But I don't know where they are.
If they have that, sell that, because I want to buy that.
I can say they're behind a tower or a section of the roof or something. You know, who knows?
Okay, all right, I can buy it. And then my third little thing is not really Batman killing, because I've accepted that as sort of I'd prefer that he didn't, but they've done that in so many live action interpretations. That's really been sort of that's sort of been the status quo, so yeah. I can't really knock it too much. The one thing I do, that smile that Batman gives when he sticks the bomb in the guy, though, that is a little too far for me. But, you know, it's just a little nitpick. Like I said, I love this movie. I love 99% of this movie, and those are just my three little – well, two now, because Andy, actually, you did help me a lot with that one. So two really nitpicks about this movie. And, otherwise,
happy
I love
to help.
It.
Happy to help.
I'm helping. So he's helped us both.
Thank you, Andy. Yeah.
Well, the one thing I forgot to mention, and it kind of goes along the lines of what I was saying about the design of Gotham. Like, I actually love – the design work that was done in this film for Gotham. But, you know, one of the things that, one of the criticisms I hear about this movie, but to be fair, I think it's true of all the Burton Schumacher movies, is how soundstagey it feels.
Right.
And I agree with that too. I think I wish that there had been at least a couple scenes where they shot out in the open, so it didn't all feel like it was inside a box. But again, I feel like that's pretty true for all four of these movies. In Batman 89, it's just that one strip of street that where they go outside. Batman Forever, there's like one shot that's outside. Everything else looks like it's in a soundstage. So Batman and Robin, same way. So I'm like, it was kind of just consistent there. But I do wish they had found ways to cheat so it could feel more, you know, more like a real city instead of a set.
And even a couple of wide shots of you know, exterior shots of London or whatever.
Right. But I can tell you, I love those matte painting shots of Gotham. They don't look real, but they look awesome.
Oh, yeah.
To me, that's the nature of the movie.
Like I love the Dark Knight trilogy, but when I think of Gotham, Tim Burton's, like the visuals of Tim Burton's Gotham is what first comes to mind when I think about it. Right. Now, the fun part of any movie is rating the movie. Now, Andy, we have two different rating systems because Jordan likes to be difficult.
Okay.
So one of our guests came on and suggested we do a rating system of where we take something from the film we're reviewing and apply it to our rating system. So, for example, for Justice League, I rated it 7.5 Henry Cavill porn mustaches out of 10. That was my little anecdote. Okay. Or you could just give it a grade or a standard number, whatever you want. Or you can do like Jordan does and give it a letter grade.
I always do letter grades on my show, but I'm on your turf. So you tell me how you want to grade.
Andy, a letter grade is fine. Like Adam was saying, he says I'm difficult by doing a letter grade. I think it's the easiest. So you go ahead, Andy, because I'm going to do the same.
Okay. So, I mean, I know what my letter grade is because, like I said, that's I always do. For me, the letter grade is an A. I love the movie. I love how unique and different it is. I love the risks that were taken. I love the chances they took with the characters and creating these really, to me, very compelling versions of these classic characters. And to me, it's just a terrific and interesting movie. And it's one of those movies that, because it's so interesting, that 25 years, I still pick up on things like the couple of the things I shared with you guys. Those are relatively recent discoveries. I didn't notice those in 1992. Oh, cool.
We got exclusives here from
it. Yeah, that just comes from revisiting the film year after year. It's a favorite of mine. It's one of those that I can watch almost any time. But I generally reserve Christmas time to watch it. So yeah, I'd give it an A for a letter grade. So I guess that would be 9.8 mistletoe kisses out of 10.
Oh, that's a good one. I like that.
Okay.
You covered both bases. There we go.
See, I'll
play the game. It's
he's
fine.
An adaptive co-host. See, that's take your cue, learn something, Jordan. What's your letter grade? What's your plain Jane letter grade? What's it going to be?
Yeah, well, mine's an A. I love this movie. It's like I said, before 2005, it's my favorite DC movie of all time. So up until the Dark Knight trilogy began, it was. And I love this movie. I love the performances in this movie, I should say. I love the Bat-Cat relationship as it's depicted in this movie. I love it's very stylized. It's very Burton-y. It's very much Burton's take on the Batman universe, but I love almost every second of it. So, A for me.
Yeah, I absolutely love it. I think I never get tired of it. To me, it never loses its luster. It's not like I don't feel like I'm watching a 25-year-old movie or however old it is now. And I will always have a special place in my heart for Michael Keaton as Batman. And Michelle Pfeiffer, what more can you say? It's Michelle Pfeiffer's inclusion in Ant-Man is the only reason I'm really excited about that movie. I'll just say that. So with that being said, I'm going to give Batman Returns 8.5 Batman Bat Hangers out of 10.
Oh, there it is.
And you were waiting for that word, Shandy. By the way, Jamie's never going to come on our show now because I did that, but...
Oh, he will. He's used to it at this point. See, so like we talked about our negatives and like our little nitpicks when we did this and he brought up the bat hangers and he's like, it loses a whole grade because of bat hangers. I was like, what?
That's ridiculous.
What are you talking about, you crazy person? Like, I never thought twice about it. And it's so funny that like for 25 years, it's been it's been a pain in his side. Who knew? Like,
well, he's
like,
never he's never heard the end of it.
Oh, I know. He's paid for it dearly.
And I just have to add to it. But Andy, thank you so much for coming on. It was great having you. Thanks for celebrating Christmas with us. I want to wish you a Merry Christmas, your family a Merry Christmas. And thanks for coming on. And hopefully we can, in the new year, we'll arrange to do, because I know Robin is one of your favorite characters, specifically Tim Drake. So Jordan, I was telling him that we'd have him back for a Tim Drake specific Robin maybe story, or one of the episode of the animated series when Tim Drake comes in, or you know, when Titans kicks off, we can get him on to talk about. I know it's not Tim Drake, but we'll figure something out. But it'll definitely be a Robin inspired podcast, and at that point we'll take questions from the audience. We couldn't this week, but we will the next time you're on. But thanks again for joining us.
Yeah, for sure. Thanks.
You want to plug, Andy?
Oh, thank you. Well, first of all, thank you guys again for the invite. I really do appreciate it. Really cool to be on the Christmas episode. Really fun to talk about this movie that I love. So again, thank you so much. I do appreciate it. Yeah, I mean, and for those of you guys listening, if you can't get enough Batman or DC talk, just check out my show, Holy Batcast. You can find it wherever you find your podcasts. But if you want one-stop shopping, you can just go to holybatcast.com and find everything there. But yeah, and you can follow that on Twitter and on Instagram and YouTube and all that stuff. But yeah. Always waste a lot of time talking about Batman.
I know your show gets a big thumbs up from both me and Adam. So yes. Great work over there, and thank you so much for coming on, man. It was a pleasure to have you on.
My pleasure was all mine. Thumbs up right back at you.
And Jordan, if anybody wants to talk to you about further Batcat related topics, where can we track you down?
Oh, yeah. Come talk to me on Twitter. Come discuss the Batman Annual, the most recent one, Batman Annual number 2, with me, please, because that was phenomenal. And I've been talking a lot of Batcat recently on Twitter with regards specifically to that. So you can find me on both Twitter and on Instagram. My handle on both is at BatFanJordanV. Also, one more thing I wanted to say is we are now a proud member of the Batman Podcast Network. So go to BatmanPodcastNetwork.com to check out all the other great Batastic podcast there, including Holy Batcast, of course. And thanks again to Batman on Film, to Bill Raimi for adding us to that network. And also, if you like this episode, if you want to leave a review on iTunes, that would help us out a lot. So thanks for listening.
And if you want to follow me, it's Twitter at Superhero Sci-Fi. And once again, I want to wish all our listeners Merry Christmas, Happy Holidays if you don't celebrate Christmas, and enjoy your family, enjoy your friends, and we'll talk to you soon. So long, everybody.
Bye-bye.
Merry Christmas.